Long before Mary Poppins danced across the rooftops of Edwardian London into the hearts of millions, Robert and Richard Sherman were struggling songwriters in Los Angeles, California, trying to find their voices and their futures. In the new book, Making Mary Poppins, The Sherman Brothers, Walt Disney, and the Creation of a Classic Film, author and Disney historian Todd James Pierce traces the unlikely path that brought the Sherman Brothers to Walt Disney's attention and how their personal history, musical genius, and emotional lives shaped the film's songs and surprising storyline. Todd James Pierce is an author, professor of English, and host of the popular Disney History Institute podcast. Again, the name of the book is Making Mary Poppins, and it's a pleasure to welcome Todd to the roundtable this morning. Todd, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me here, Joe.
So at what point in given your interest in Disney and your interest in the work there to say, I want to focus in on Mary Poppins and look at this film specifically?
Well, I had previously done some work on a person named Larry Watkin, who did a lot of the scripts for the 1950s Disney live-action films. And it became clear that there was two main modes to make a movie. Either they percolated over years, as did a film called Darby O'Gill and the Little People, or they were made in about a year from script to screen. And the other example of the film that really percolated a long time was Mary Poppins, which I think is one of the superior efforts of the Disney studio from the 50s and 60s. And so that's what got me started on the project.
When does it come under the radar of Disney that this is a property they would like to work on?
In the 1940s.
Okay.
About 20 years before it's released.
And so two obvious questions. What did they see in it initially? And then what took so long?
They can't get the rights from Pamela Travers. Her books are very popular in the 40s and 50s. And so she doesn't really need to work with a studio to sustain her lifestyle, essentially. It's her only form of income. I think the Disney company sees in these projects the way to mix animation with live action. Disney's doing some live-action animation mixing in the 1940s with films like So Dear to My Heart and Song of the South. And so this is a lower-cost way for an animation studio to still have animated elements, but to produce a feature film which has a higher profit potential. And so I think there's this practical aspect that interests Walt. And plus, I think he adores the stories. This is one of the few projects that he goes after for decades until it finally comes together.
When do the Sherman Brothers become involved in this project?
About 4 years before its release. And Disney does not have the rights to produce the film yet. They have some development rights, but Pamela Travers, the author, can turn them down at any point in the process up through 1961. And so they're developing a film on spec, which is very expensive to do in-house. They don't know that this is going to move forward. And they even have a backup plan. They think that if Pamela Travers walks away from this project, they can take the songs that the Sherman Brothers have written and apply them to another film, which they call The Time the Magic Bedknob, but later becomes Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
So working with the author of these very popular books is difficult, and because, as you say, doesn't necessarily need the money, but I would also think there's some propriety there of saying, well, you know, don't screw around with the the product that I've put into this world.
Yes, so there's a lot of protectionism from Travers over her characters and how she wants them presented. Some of her requests are really kind of ridiculous in terms of moving the film forward. But the income thing is really the issue that I think allows the film to get made. Her book sales start to fall off in the 1960s, and this is her only form of income again. And so I think the Disney studio and Pamela Travers knows that she's in a difficult spot where she needs the money from the film and the interest from the film in terms of rejuvenating interest in her books. And so I think Disney, by the time they have Pamela Travers out for a multi-day meeting that goes, I would say, terribly, that they know, even though it's not going well with Pamela Travers, that the financial elements of her situation are likely going to push her to sign the contract so the film can move forward. The film that we know is largely invented, the story by the Sherman brothers, the story about Mr. Banks being a distant father, the generational divide between him and the kids, that's not really part of the book itself. The one that they're mostly working with, it's a book series. They're mostly working with the first book. It's a series of short stories that are meant to be read to kids at night, 10, 15 minutes. I did that with my kids years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's simply no through line in them to create a straightforward chronological movie that's going to have rising tension and feel like either a Broadway musical or other films that are out at that time. So Pamela Travers is essentially agreeing that her characters are going to be used in a storyline that she didn't invent, but has set pieces that are taken from the individual sections of her first book.
On that, you write, for the Shermans, the composition process for Mary Poppins was far different from that of their other assignments. For Mary Poppins, they were assembling a project in which each song and each story idea changed the material around it. If you altered one story beat, you needed to revise the lyrics in three, maybe four songs. So this was that's a careful balancing act.
Yes. So before this, the Sherman Brothers had done a number of projects for Disney, and they were songwriters that contributed material to finished scripts. So they would take a look at the finished script, the story's all locked down, and they would come up with stories that hit beats, usually slow beats. That's what music was often used for, to kind of move through sections of the story that were character development. So they put in music for an already finished script, so they know what's going to be in the movie. For Mary Poppins, they are literally given a hardcover copy of the book and are told to go make something out of this. And so they don't have a finished script. So they're developing the story and the music at the same time. And the Sherman Brothers, just before this, they had started out as country western songwriters, which I think most people don't know. And then they had a period where they were novelty pop rock writers, but they got to know the teen audience through that. And now they're working on Mary Poppins, and some of their novelty rock songs for the youth generation of 1960s really comes into play here. The songs are all musically keyed to the turn of the century. At least most of them are, not all. Most of them are keyed to the turn of the century. But they take what they've learned from teen lifestyles, from movies like Rebel Without a Cause. And whether consciously or not, they structure the plot around generational divides that are huge in America in the early 1960s. And that's what Mary Poppins is about. It's an American story about parents not understanding their own kids and the problems that come from that. But it's set as a musical fantasy with animated elements in Edwardian London. So I think it's able to sneak its message in there. The teen exploitation flicks of the 1950s and 60s, parents don't go to see. But they'll go to see Mary Poppins, that it has the same story, structure, and same message inside of it.
How crucial was the casting and the behind the scenes of developing the story and ultimately having the film move forward?
I think the casting is really brilliant. The movie becomes about the redemption of Mr. Banks, who's played by David Tomlinson.
Yep.
David Tomlinson's character is not a very verbal character. And this is a very talky movie, too. Very talky, lots of lyrics in the song. So there's lots of vocal expressions. David Tomlinson's character doesn't have a lot of self-knowledge, and he doesn't really have the means to communicate outside of the business speak that he's used to at the bank where he works. And so David Tomlinson has to carry the movie in many ways through gestures, facial expressions, and nuanced vocal modulation. And so if you watch the camera movements in this film, other characters will be talking, which will be the natural place to put the camera. You put the camera on who's speaking or who's singing. In this movie, the director shifts the camera many times over to David Tomlinson because this is how the story is developed, by noticing how he responds to things. Late in the movie, Bert, which is the character played by Dick Van Dyke, has a song where he explains that Mr. Banks is failing as a father. The camera really should be on Dick Van Dyke while he's singing. The camera stays glued to David Tomlinson because to make the plot advance, we need to see how he's processing this information. And he can't talk about it. This character's not good at that. So we have to see, you know, how the reticence is changing inside of him through little movements of his face. So the casting here throughout, I think, is really well done and is essential in many places for getting the film to work.
And as far as the rapport and the chemistry between Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke, I mean, that's, you win the lottery on that.
I think so, yes. I think Dick Van Dyke with his questionable Cockney accent, I think.
Yeah.
And Mary Poppins.
Which, yeah. I mean, he has certainly said over the years that it was awful.
Well, I wouldn't say awful.
Yeah. His words, but yeah.
Most convincing.
Right.
But it's a transformative film for the people who work on it, too. So Julie Andrews had never been in a Hollywood movie before. She'd been on stage in the West End and on Broadway. And she was interested in coming out and working in Hollywood for Warner Brothers for My Fair Lady, but she wasn't picked for the role. And so she's new to Hollywood. She has a number of concerns about working on a film. If you're in a musical that's performed every night, at a certain point, you get used to how the audience is going to react, and you can play into that. The audience is giving you feedback that's telling you which lines are working, how to present them, how to voice your songs, and so on. And she's worried that she's going to have no feedback before she has to get in front of the camera. Dick Van Dyke had been in two previous movies, one of which he didn't really care for. and he has his TV series. His TV series is fairly new at this point. But he's a younger, up-and-coming actor. I think that there's just some natural camaraderie between the two of them because they're both thrust into new career positions for themselves. This is going to be a big, expensive movie with a premiere and a lot of publicity. And they're both a little nervous about how to act inside of this world. So I think there's some bonding that goes on between them on set. It has a very long shooting schedule. They have barbecues on weekends. They get together quite a bit, both the cast and the crew. It was unusual for the crew to get together with the cast, and that happens here as well. So there's a very nice community that's built up over the many months that the film is shot.
Todd James Pierce is the author of Making Mary Poppins, the new book, and our guest on the roundtable this morning. It's interesting to me that you talk about this in a few of the scenes, but from your perspective, the most challenging for filmmakers, the most challenging scene was what?
What was the most challenging scene? It's got to either be the Jolly Holidays.
Jolly Holidays.
The animation is not there, and they're using the sodium vapor process for the first time in this feature film. And so there's some technology issues. And there's also the issue of trying to get the kids to understand how to act with characters that they can't see. So I think there's some challenges there. And there's also challenges with all the practical effects that are used for the Uncle Albert sequence, where they have tea up on the ceiling and they have, you know, back in 1963 when this is shot, they had all kinds of very inventive tricks with wires, with things that look like teeter-totters, with devices that made people look like they were floating to get them through that sequence. That took many days to shoot as well. So I think those are the two big standouts in terms of production challenges.
And you read in the book that Jolly Holiday, as far as post-production, took longer than certainly most scenes would in a Disney film.
Yeah, so they try some things out with the Jolly Holiday sequence. So there's some development that happens there. They originally want the animation to look like it's a chalk drawing with pastels and fuzzy edges and things like that. So they do at least a test on this. And then they decide it's not working until they move over to something that I would say looks more like the 1950s, 1960s house style of Disney short animation anyway. So it's very identifiable characters with firm lines and familiar backgrounds. And so the Jolly Holiday sequence is shot first, specifically so that the material can be handed over to the animation department so they can work with it for about a year before it needs to be cut into the finished film. So that's the one that really has that kind of long delay. Hand-drawn animation just by itself takes a long time anyways.
What was the initial reaction when that was shown in a theater for the first time, that scene? What was the reaction?
I only know the reaction for the first time that it was shown in the theater for the entire movie. It was shown to a prestige audience. It's going to be an audience in L.A. at the Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Yep.
It's also a fundraising event for a college that Walt Disney has participated in building. That's called CalArts. It's in Valencia now. And so I imagine that this particular audience, high ticket values, and so it's going to be very quiet and respectful. People come in gowns and tuxes. At the end of the movie, there is applause swell through that auditorium in appreciation for the film they saw. But I sort of suspect that this is the audience that's going to very quietly watch the movie all the way through, as though it's a cultural event.
Well, admittedly, I'm leading the witness, but as a viewer of this film, and I still even to this day, when I see that scene, when I see the Jolly Holiday scene, it's you feel like standing up and giving a standing ovation. It's absolutely perfect and amazing. It's still stunning.
I think that when people remember the movie now, they remember the music. And also the exuberance that's expressed on screen, particularly by characters Mary Poppins and Bert, Julie Andrews, yeah, and Dick Van Dyke. There is a palpable joy that comes off the screen, especially from the sections that you're pointing to.
Because it's also unrelenting. It's just, it goes and goes and goes, and it just keeps upping the ante to this point where you're like, oh goodness, that was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a movie that I think does really well in the 1960s for two reasons. And the first one is the one that you're pointing to, the music and the celebration that's embedded into the performance of those songs. And I also think that many people go see this movie and they see the problems of generational divide being played out on screen, but they don't understand what it is. And so they leave the theater with this kind of mysterious emotion that they're carrying based on what they've seen, and it isn't decoded for them. And so I think those are the two real strong points that capture the 1964 and 1965 audience for the film.
What was your, did you look into the reaction of the film versus the reaction to the stage production of it, of it's because it gives you an appreciation of the film when you realize of what it was like to put it on stage.
I saw the stage production. I saw it in previews in New York. Jeez. I want to say that was early 2000s, like,
yeah,
2000, oh, maybe sounds late 2006 or 7, somewhere around there. I forget, actually, somewhere in that neighborhood. I remember when I went, they were having problems with the house set, and I was thinking, like, I hope this, if the house set didn't function properly, they cut the play, they gave you your money back, and that was it for the night. I was like, I hope we get to the whole thing. I remember being really impressed by what they did on the stage, but in terms of my own research, it goes up through the wide release of 1965, and that's kind of where,
yeah,
my actual research ends.
And the overall reaction from the studio is what, of at the end of the day, when the film goes out and goes out into the world, they feel that they have accomplished what?
Oh, it's transformative for, yeah, the studio on a number of levels. The Disney studio up until this time in the Hollywood community has been relegated as this kind of animation oddity that exists down the way from Warner Brothers. It's about like a mile from the Warner Brothers lot. It's not considered a serious studio. They produce animated films for kids, maybe a family audience, and then they produce live-action films that are mostly considered for a juvenile audience. And so Mary Poppins is the first time that other Hollywood studios start to imitate a trend that Disney started. So you get films like Dr. Dolittle, you get Oliver, you get Sound of Music. These are all attempts to kind of capture the musical vibe that Disney has initiated on screen in 1964. These types of Broadway-esque musical family films moving forward. But financially, this just changes the outlook for the Disney company. The really good example, I think, is this one. In April 1964, Walt goes to the New York World's Fair. He goes there with a person named Bob Foster, who's a lawyer from Disneyland. And Bob Foster's job is to go down to Florida and to buy some land for this Disneyland East project that they're thinking about going forward with. And he's told to buy about 5,000 acres, or if need be, he could go up to 10,000. The big thing is that they want a lake, and you have to buy all the land around the lake in Florida to control the lake. Otherwise, there's public access to it. And so 5,000, maybe 10,000. After the success of Mary Poppins, they have a lot of money, and Walt keeps upping how much Bob Foster can spend on land. And so he's eventually allowed to purchase 27,000 acres, over five times what was originally requested. And that is directly attributable to the financial success of Mary Poppins. So it changes what the Disney company is.
The name of the new book is Making Mary Poppins, The Sherman Brothers, Walt Disney, and the Creation of the Classic Film. The book is published by Norton. Todd James Pierce, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Be well. Again, the name of the book is Making Mary Poppins, The Sherman Brothers, Walt Disney, and the Creation of the Classic Film. The book is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.